I'm Chris Reback.
And I'm Tegan Goddard.
You're listening to the free version of Trial Balloon.
Visit trialballoon.fm to get new episodes every week and more.
Sounds like you are in a third location over the last 3 weeks.
I am in Political Wire's world headquarters, new world headquarters here in my home office, which is redone, Chris. Very exciting.
It's very, very exciting. It's sounding very good. Sounding just a little bit echoey, but I know this is only day three in the space, maybe day one of recording. So there may be some things. I know you're surrounded just by boxes and bare walls at this point. But anyhow, welcome home.
Thanks, Chris. And yeah, I'll get a carpet on the floor. The acoustics will be a little bit better in future episodes.
Why don't we go right at it? If folks want to send questions for the mailbag, you can contact Tegan via Political Wire or email me simply by replying to any day's newsletter. Now let's get on with business. Last week, we started with speculation of whether Trump really would make his statement on abortion. Two big surprises. One, he actually did it. And two, he got about 24 hours of quasi-peace on the issue, and then the Arizona Supreme Court spoke. Most of our listeners know the facts. Trump said, let the states decide, and Arizona decided that an 1864 ban on abortion made before women could vote is constitutional and stands. Here's what you wrote. Trump flails on abortion. After weeks of trying to come up with yet another position on abortion, Donald Trump thought he was clever to finally say on Monday that he would just leave it up to the states. The next day, the Arizona Supreme Court reinstated the 1864 law that banned abortion outright. It's one of the most draconian abortion bans in the nation. Trump and Republicans have been scrambling ever since. After the court's decision, Arizona U.S. Senate candidate Carrie Lake and even Sean Hannity insisted that the 1864 law would be, quote, fixed in a week or two. But Arizona Republicans had different plans and blocked an attempt to repeal the 160-year-old abortion ban. One very clear sign that Trump is feeling the pressure is that he reiterated he would not sign a national abortion ban if it came to his desk in a second term. Of course, no one believes him. The Biden campaign's response to all of this is very simple. Donald Trump did this. It's an effective attack because it's completely true. If not for Trump, abortion would still be legal throughout the country. Before Roe v. Wade was repealed, it was easy for Republicans to stay united on their anti-abortion message. After repeal, it's obvious that Republicans are deeply divided, and in politics, the divided side almost always loses. My question on this, is there even a needle here for Trump to thread? What are his options?
Well, Chris, it's really funny that just last week we joked about whether Trump would or would not actually make a position on abortion. I think it's because we sensed that it was very hard for him to do anything that wasn't going to make everybody angry. And sure enough, after he came out with his statement on Monday, he made everybody angry. He made the far right, the anti-abortion crowd, very angry with the fact that he was no longer supportive of a national ban. He obviously did nothing to sway people who favor abortion rights, because obviously we've seen what's happened in states like Florida and now in Arizona. There are very, very harsh laws in restricting abortion rights in those states and obviously across the South particularly. So the best thing probably was to continue to shut his mouth and to actually not say anything. I don't think he really benefited much at all by making a statement. And then it was, of course, just made dramatically worse when the Arizona Supreme Court dropped the hammer, reinstated a 160-year-old law before Arizona was a state, before women could vote. I mean, it's extraordinary. And it's one of the most draconian laws in the country. This was a terrible week for Donald Trump. It was an unbelievably good turn of events for Joe Biden. I really do believe, as I wrote, that slogan, Donald Trump did this, you're going to hear that over and over and over again, whether it's a situation like this where a zombie law on the books is brought back to life, or whether all of these deeply personal, often just emotionally wrenching stories that you read about women whose lives were in danger because they were no longer able to get reproductive health care. Those stories are going to come out week after week, all the way to the end of the election. And that is just bad news for Donald Trump. And it's bad news for most Republicans as well.
Well, before we start talking about how great of a week it was for Biden, we've got other things to discuss that weren't as good for Biden. But let's continue on this one. Did Trump have a choice? I mean, okay, fine. He had a choice to not say anything and to continue to kick the can down the road, which you and I both thought he would do. I think many people thought he would do because that's kind of one of his primary tactics. However, the issue obviously was never going to go away. Is there a needle that he can thread on it? Given all of the terrible political choices, and that's what we're talking about here, the politics of this, is sticking to the story, states' rights. We all believe in states' rights, or at least the Republicans do, or people that he's speaking for and with do. We believe in states' rights. That's where this went. Some states are going to do this beautifully. Some states are going to do this not so beautifully, and we're going to try to turn them around. But states' rights, we push this back to the states. Did he at least politically take the best route that he could?
I'm not so sure he did. I think he might have been better off saying nothing and being ambiguous about it, actually. And the reason is that he has essentially opened himself up for attack. I talked about the Joe Biden line, Donald Trump did this. And the reason it's so effective, as you reiterated, it's true, but it's also because the majority of Americans support abortion rights, and there's no getting around that. So there is no middle ground threading the needle where somehow you're going to pluck off enough Americans so that you're on the majority side. Donald Trump's on the losing side of this issue. And if this issue is the issue that people go into the polls to vote on, it's a loser for him. There's nothing he can do given what he's done so far, both his track record by appointing three Supreme Court justices who helped overturn Roe v. Wade, or his bragging about the fact that he's the one who finally brought this issue to the states. There's nothing he can do.
Is it less of a losing issue for him to hang his hat on states' rights as opposed to saying nothing?
I'm not so sure that you can do much with this at all, but I think saying nothing would allow Donald Trump to continue this ambiguous position that he's had pretty much throughout his career, both as a real estate developer and celebrity and as a politician. Nobody's quite sure where Donald Trump stands on the issue because he's literally taken every side of this issue at one point or another over the last 25 years. I think he probably could have just drawn that out a little bit more. Now, would it have worked? I'm not sure it would have worked. I think, unfortunately for Trump, he is the one responsible. He is the one who did this. And Joe Biden's going to remind voters every single week from now until November that Donald Trump did this.
So if abortion was one of the one-word political and policy topics of the week, another one was economy. The Financial Times reports, on Wednesday, U.S. inflation surpassed expectations, and Joe Biden acknowledged there was, quote, more to do on fighting price rises. Bond yields jumped, stocks slid, and markets pushed back their forecasts of summer rate cuts after official data showed a 3.5% increase in consumer prices for the year to March. Quote, you have to take seriously the possibility that the next rate move will be upwards rather than downwards, former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers said, and a sign of the effect of the inflation data on rate expectations. The Wall Street Journal added, details within the report were just as concerning as the headline numbers, analysts said. The overall core index climbed 0.4% from the previous month, despite a decline in the prices of goods such as new and used cars and trucks. A problem area was services outside of housing. That category, which includes everything from car insurance to medical care, has been flagged by Fed officials as particularly important because it can be sticky and closely linked to the strength of the labor market. The cost of shelter also increased 0.4% from February, continuing to defy predictions that it would start rising more slowly given private sector indexes that have shown a marked slowdown in new rents. You then noted in a piece that you titled, Fed may not cut interest rates this year. In the wake of yesterday's hotter than expected inflation numbers, Minneapolis Fed President Neel Kashkari told PBS the central bank may not cut interest rates at all this year unless the trend changes, said Kashkari. The longer that inflation just moves sideways and doesn't actually move back down, that would make me say we should pause indefinitely until we see that confidence that inflation is beat. My question, how much trouble is Biden in?
Well, it's a good question because obviously it's the economy, stupid. I wouldn't necessarily have thought it was as big an issue this week if it weren't for a conversation that I had with a longtime Political Wire reader who is running for Congress in a very competitive district. I don't want to talk too much about the conversation, but if there was a takeaway from the conversation, it's that every meeting that he goes to, every door that he knocks on, and he's been campaigning hard for the last 6 weeks or so, every single person brings up the cost of living. It is an issue. It is a big issue. And that's what he's saying. His point is that that is what President Biden needs to be focused on, because it is a very big issue for everyone in his district. That's not what you necessarily get when you're reading the newspapers, when you're reading other political analysis. Obviously, we know intrinsically the economy is important, but we don't really think about how many voters are really only focused on what their experience is when they go to the grocery store, when they go to the gas pump, and that they don't really think about the rest of the political world that much, but they do think about what things cost them. You and I had a conversation earlier this week about how we've noticed that the price of going out to dinner, it's definitely more than it used to be. And sometimes it's a little shocking when you just go out and have a pretty normal dinner and all of a sudden it costs you $20 more than it did just a few years ago. So the fact that this is a congressional candidate is seeing this when he's talking to voters, it does make me think that it's a bigger issue than I think many Political Wire readers have given it credit for.
Things are really expensive. I was in California just a couple of weeks ago. Gas is over $5 still. Back in September, I was there and it was pushing $6. It's still above $5. Going out to dinner, going to the grocery store, for sure. Stuff is expensive. Reframing the question I asked just a moment ago regarding Trump and abortion, is there a needle that Biden can thread on the economy?
I actually do think that there's something that Biden can say on this. Obviously, he's done a little bit talking about inflation. You know, he's used this concept of shrinkflation to turn this issue into more of it's just corporations gouging you and to take a more populist position on this. But I think the flip side of all of this is that the economy is growing and that people are employed and that people have jobs and that ultimately what matters is, are people's incomes keeping up with the price of goods? So while sticker shock may be a real political problem for Biden and for many Democrats, the fact that realistically, when you go to the grocery store, if your income has risen as well, if the money that you're bringing home and that you're buying goods with, perhaps you won't notice it nearly as much. Obviously, Biden would be in terrible trouble if the unemployment rate was skyrocketing and we were in a recession right now. I would say without a doubt, the economy would be a problem for him. Right now, the economy is extremely strong. And unfortunately for Biden, that's one of the reasons why we do have this inflation problem, is that the economy is much stronger than anyone probably gave it credit for. Most people thought we'd have a recession by the end of last year. We did not. Nobody's forecasting a recession right now. Instead, we're seeing this idea that inflation is just stubbornly staying stagnant at about 3%, 3.5% annually. And yes, that's a problem because year after year, that adds up and people start noticing that things cost more.
I agree. Jobs continue to be created. The job numbers go up every month, but wages aren't increasing at the same rate as inflation, are they?
We've seen a lot of evidence that they are, actually. Obviously, when you have a tight labor market, you know, employers need to start bidding up what they pay workers in order to get them to come to their companies. So yeah, we have seen that. The data is not exactly perfect, but we have seen plenty of data that suggests that wages are keeping up with inflation. And so that's a good sign, but there's the practical impact of that. Yes, you see your wages go up, but it doesn't mean you're still not shocked by the price of that cup of coffee that you bought.
Doesn't mean that you're feeling any wealthier. You and I have continually said that we believe this election will come down to abortion and the economy versus immigration and crime, with obviously international affairs like Ukraine, Gaza, and who knows, perhaps an Iran-Israel war thrown in there. Let's focus on the two topics of today, abortion and the economy. First of all, which one trumps the other? And would we actually need to look at it state by state? And here's what I mean. For swing states, might there be one that actually outweighs the other? For example, Arizona versus Michigan. I don't know exactly where each state's economy specifically stands, but given that Arizona is in the Southwest, perhaps Arizona has a stronger economy, but obvious abortion challenges, while Michigan's economy is potentially worse off, but it also has had abortion political challenges. Plus, of course, it's got a significant Arab American population. How are you thinking about abortion versus the economy? Does one trump the other?
I think the economy trumps every issue at the end of the day. I think that abortion is a unique issue, though, because for the first time in all of our lifetimes, Americans have had a right, a fundamental right, taken away from them. And that's never happened before. So while the rule is always, it's the economy, stupid, we've never been in a situation where we've actually had a right taken away. And if you look at the Biden campaign's broader theme on democracy versus autocracy, that's really what this is about. It's about an autocratic challenger to President Biden in Donald Trump, potentially taking away the rights of Americans if he turns this country into an autocracy. And so it's really hard to actually get between the two issues because of the nuances. I think we can stick with our general view that they are going to be important issues in this election. I like the framing that you use about looking at it state by state, because at the end of the day, the presidential race is decided in the Electoral College. Arizona has always been in play, but Arizona has now given Joe Biden's campaign a huge boost because every single race in that state will be about this abortion issue at this time. It doesn't mean the economy won't be important there too, but we know that voters are going to go to the polls to vote on abortion in Arizona. In Michigan, that's less likely. And you raised the point about Gaza and the Palestinian population in Michigan possibly being a factor. I think that suggests that when we look at this presidential race, we have to always remember, because we see so many national polls that come out, but we have to remember that this race will be decided state by state. Each of those states has unique challenges. It's really interesting because I can't say that in a very close race that I would have thought that Arizona would lean towards Joe Biden. I thought it would actually potentially be hard, in that Joe Biden's best path to Electoral College victory was through the Rust Belt states. And if he could win those blue wall states of Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, that he would be safe and that he could be reelected. But if he also is able to win in Arizona, it's game over for Donald Trump.
And with that, let's get one mailbag question in, because it ties to a topic that I was hoping we would get to talk about this week, which is this question about, will Biden make it onto red state ballots? And the note comes from Janice A., who writes, I just read that Biden may not make the ballot in Ohio because they have in their statute a date by which the nominee has to be selected and the DNC convention comes after that date. I'm sure there is something very obvious I'm missing, but how does this mesh with the Supreme Court decision that allowing states to decide who can be on the ballot would lead to chaos when looking at the January 6th issue? What would stop a state from passing a law that puts the date by which the nominee has to be selected well before any convention may be held, so then they can control whether or not a particular candidate is on the ballot? Thinking about Ohio saying their legislature could change the law. Maybe I'm going down too many rabbit holes, dot, dot, dot. Well, to prove that Janice A. is not going down too many rabbit holes, you posted this week that Republican secretaries of state in Ohio and Alabama have told Democrats that their presidential ticket might not qualify for their ballots, warning that the party's nominating convention in Chicago will come too late to make their deadline, Semaphore reports. Now get this. In 2020, both Ohio and Alabama had ballot deadlines after the Republican National Convention. In both states, there was no real conflict over placing the Trump-Pence ticket. Ohio legislators passed a law shrinking the ballot grace period from 90 days to 60 days for that cycle, while Alabama accepted a letter from the Republican National Committee promising to, quote, certify the party's nominees as soon as the official nomination is complete, end quote. Back to Semaphore, but Democrats are taking the new challenges seriously and see four paths to resolving any ballot access questions. There is no way that these states would act one way in 2020 and then another way in 2024, especially after, as you wrote, the Supreme Court ruled that no single state could disqualify a presidential candidate in the 14th Amendment challenges to Trump's candidacy. We're safe here, right?
Well, your sarcasm is coming through loud and clear, Chris, because, yeah, obviously people do whatever they want to do at the time. And that's why they call it a flip-flop. People change their positions all the time, given the political circumstances. But Janice asks just a fantastic question. And, you know, I read as much political news and analysis as anybody. And Janice was the first one to actually bring this to my attention. And I didn't see anyone writing about it for several days You know, Janice kind of dismissed her own question, thinking she must not be thinking about it the right way because it seems so crazy. But sure enough, that's exactly what's happening here. And what I think would be interesting, and I'm sure the Biden campaign does not want this to happen, but I'd be curious to know, what would the Supreme Court do if a challenge came to the Supreme Court after they ruled on the 14th Amendment that no one state can decide who the nominees are going to be nationally, when right now we've got two states essentially saying to Joe Biden's campaign, yeah, you're not going to make the ticket because your convention is being held too late. I mean, I find that really interesting, just intellectually. What would the Supreme Court do? I suspect that lawyers are working on it and that there is some way around this. But if not, then talk about going nuclear on election administration. I mean, every state around will be adjusting their laws in order to somehow knock the opposing party off the ballot if they have control of the state. I mean, it's kind of amazing, really. And it's a great question by Janice. And it's one that really, to this point, hasn't been fully answered yet. We're not sure what's going to happen because the laws in these states are actually pretty clear. It's just that they've made exceptions in the past and they might not make an exception this time.
Who even knew that historically this was a thing?
I don't know exactly. The fact that, you know, a mere letter would kind of dismiss this entire thing in past years, but now you've got Republican officials threatening to keep Biden off the ballot. It just shows you how our politics has gotten really in the trenches nasty. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, when you study World War I and how that war was fought in the trenches, hand-to-hand combat, often over small pieces of land. It seems like that's where our politics is headed right now.
Well, how about another trench, Nebraska's 2nd District?
Yeah, that's a great point. That's a great point. The idea that Nebraska was attempting to become a winner-take-all state rather than awarding electoral votes by congressional district as they have for many years is, again, it's one of those hardball moves. I mean, this was actually raised by Charlie Kirk, a conservative agitator who got lawmakers in Nebraska to act. Now, ultimately, it did not happen. It did not pass in the session time that they had left. But it doesn't mean it can't pass. And in a red state like Nebraska, I wouldn't be surprised if all of a sudden Nebraska was able to pass a law becoming a winner-take-all state and taking away that one electoral vote that Democrats had a chance of winning in the Omaha district. But really, yeah, it's another great example, Chris, of just how our politics is now fought in the trenches for one vote at a time, one electoral vote at a time in this instance.
I saw a quote from a woman in Nebraska who wanted this overturned, who said, "I just can't believe that in a red state like Nebraska, I can't imagine even one of our electoral votes going to Biden." She said, "That just has to stop." That's where the sentiment is.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm not sure what the history of that law is of moving from winner take all, where you start allocating your votes by electoral district. There's two states that do it, Nebraska and Maine. But it's pretty interesting to see that all of a sudden the politics are that maybe we don't want to be a state like that anymore. Maybe if we were a winner take all state, maybe we could help our party's candidate. So, you know, politics is never very predictable in my view, and it's never uninteresting, Chris. And so this is the politics of this election right now.
A quick Google search. Maine enacted this rule in advance of the 1972 presidential election, while Nebraska enacted it starting with the 1992 election. The first split happened in the 2008 election. That year, Barack Obama won Nebraska's 2nd District, Omaha, and its suburbs, gaining a Democratic electoral vote in that state for the first time since 1964. So that doesn't quite give me the why, but it gives us just a little bit of the history. Always learning something on Trial Below.
Absolutely. And from our listeners and from our readers. I mean, it is, Janice asked a really great question.
Amen to that. Talk to you next week, Tegan.
Talk to you, Chris. Bye.